You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain.
Come to the Dark Side, Part 2.
Evil Leg Locks and the Evil Leg Lockers Who Lock Legs. The Russian Story. In this four-part series, I'm laying out the story of the controversy regarding the use of leg locks in submission grappling, training, and competition, and doing my best to make the case that, at least in the modern grappling game, these maligned techniques deserve an equal place. Last episode, in part one, I told the Brazilian part of this story. Today I will tell you the Russian part of the story. But first, as for my personal history with leg locks, I began learning them, along with a full complement of other submission holds, in the late 1980s from Dan Inosanto, and then in the 90s from Eric Paulson. The leg locks I learned were mostly derived from shoot wrestling, which in turn got them from Russian Sambo. I had already been practicing leg locks for the better part of a decade when I began training in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. This history inoculated me somewhat from learning my grappling doctrine from only one source. Anyway, as I mentioned, the ultimate source of the leg locks that I was learning was Sambo. Sambo is a Russian martial art and sport that was developed mostly by two men, then almost disappeared, and then was saved for the future by a third. Viktor Spiridinov was experienced in Greco-Roman and catch wrestling, and made an extensive study of Turco-Mongolian styles of wrestling. He was wounded in the arm about 100 years ago with a bayonet in the First World War, a wound that left the arm disabled. This wound had a powerful effect on Spiridinov's further martial arts studies, leading him to seek out styles and techniques that didn't rely on a lot of upper body strength. He eventually developed his own martial arts system, which he called Samos. He was employed as an instructor at Dynamo, the legendary physical training headquarters of the NKVD, the precursor to the KGB, the notorious Soviet Intelligence and Security Agency. In addition to instructing, his duties included continuing research into other martial arts systems. This research took him all around the Eurasian landmass, including to Mongolia and China. The other major founder of Sambo, Vasily Ostchepkov, was born on Sakhalin Island, which belongs to Russia but is just north of Japan. During his childhood, the island was occupied by the Japanese as part of the terms of the treaty that had ended a war between Russia and Japan, aptly named the Russo-Japanese War. By this time, Ostchepkov was an orphan and was sent to school in Japan. While there, he began training in judo. He displayed so much talent that his sensei arranged for him to test for admission to the Kodokan, the revered world headquarters of judo, where the style's founder, Jigoro Kano, taught. He flourished under Kano-sensei's tutelage, earning his black belt in 1913, and eventually achieving the rank of Nidan, or second-degree black belt. That's a greater accomplishment than modern judo people might realize. In those days, fifth-degree black belt was as high as you could go. He learned that Kano-sensei had thoroughly studied a number of jiu-jitsu systems to gather the material needed before creating his own system, which he named judo. Ostchepkov resolved to do something similar, and upon moving back to Russia, he furthered his own martial arts research in the employ of the Soviet military. He eventually referred to the system he created as free wrestling. In 1923, that same Soviet military awarded a series of grants to a number of prominent combatives instructors, giving them time and money to travel the world in search of new martial arts techniques and concepts. This was a 10-year project, intended to contribute to an upgrade of the hand-to-hand combat training of the Red Army. Spiridonov and Ostchepkov were two of those awarded these grants, as was a man named Anatoly Kharlampiev, who was a high-level student of Ostchepkov, and who is also important to the history of Sambo. He was born into a family that had an extensive history in the circus, as well as in the prize-fighting ring. He brought significant acrobatic and boxing skills to the table before he began training under Ostchepkov. But his greatest gift was his ability to form useful political ties during the treacherously dangerous reign of dictator Joseph Stalin. But more about that later. After 10 years of searching, observing, synthesis, and systematizing, the team of military martial researchers returned home, where the information they had gathered and analyzed was combined with the already existing curricula developed by Spiridonov and Ostchepkov to form a system that would eventually be called Sambo, which is an acronym in the Russian language for Self-Defense Without Weapons. Spiridonov lived out the rest of his life as an instructor. But poor Vasily Ostchepkov, who, as I described, had lived in Japan during his youth, was arrested during the great purges of Joseph Stalin and died soon thereafter in a labor camp. His crime was that his connections to Japan raised suspicions that he was a spy for that country. If nothing further had happened in the evolution of Sambo, it would now languish as a simple form of military combatives and would not enjoy the status of a global grappling sport as it now does. Remember Ostchepkov's student and fellow researcher Anatoly Kharlampiev, the one who had the political skills to survive the Stalin era? After the death of his teacher, he used his political connections to help gain official recognition for a sport version of Sambo he had developed. He was so successful in his efforts that despite any political taint from the arrest and demise of his former teacher, sport Sambo was given the designation of Soviet National Combat Sport. Without that development, I doubt that most of us would ever have heard of Sambo. Sambo is renowned for its throwing techniques and its vast repertoire of leg locks. People who practice Sambo are called Sambists. The rules of sport Sambo have shaped the way Sambists grapple. To better understand this, it's important to know that when, in submission grappling, you attempt a submission, you take a risk. A risk that if your submission attempt fails, you will end up in a worse position than the one you were in before. Another important thing to know is that the amount of time the officials allow you to work on the ground before they force you to stand back up varies quite a bit from grappling sport to grappling sport. In BJJ, for example, once the grapplers find themselves on the ground, it's perfectly possible for them to stay there for the rest of the match, which can be as long as 10 minutes for black belts. The rules of BJJ allow plenty of time for groundwork. This means that if you risk a submission attempt and fail, and then find yourself in a bad position, your opponent may well keep you there for longer than you want, maybe much longer, using the position to wear you down, and perhaps even leading to an outcome in which you end up tapping in submission. The rules of sport Sambo regarding how long you stay on the ground are complicated and Byzantine. The upshot is that you are statistically more likely to be forced to stand up sooner and more often in Sambo than in BJJ. This reflects the fact that Sambo, like Judo, places a premium on displaying throwing skills and wishes to reflect that in the rules. Forcing the competitors to stand up sooner and more often means more opportunities for flashy, high-amplitude throws. This means that in Sambo, if you go for a submission on the ground and fail, and as a result find yourself in a bad position, you need only survive there for whatever's left of the short span of time that the referee will allow the fight to stay on the ground. This increases the incentive for attempting submissions early and often, and to spend less time on careful setups. This in turn tends to induce the athlete to move faster when going for the submission. From the perspective of a BJJ practitioner, the Sambo player develops a style that might seem reckless and crazy, but in reality, he's simply competing sensibly under the rule set. Here are some other differences in the rules of Sambo. 1. There are no points awarded for passing the guard. 2. It's illegal to employ the closed guard, meaning to cross your ankles behind the opponent's back to keep him locked in place. They consider this a form of stalling in Sambo. 3. All choking attacks are illegal. Think about it. You've thrown your opponent, and he rotates his legs towards you to protect himself, essentially pulling an open guard, which is okay under the rules. You have a very short time on the ground in which to try to end the match early with a submission. The rules forbid you to go for a choke. Your opponent's arms are shielded behind his legs, and it will take precious time to get past them, and you would score no points for doing so anyway. But his legs are right there in front of you. No wonder Sambists specialize in leg locking. All this lays out a logical reason why Sambo competitors go for leg locks a lot, and when they do go for them, they go hard and fast. This, unfortunately, has led to some misunderstandings when some Sambists train with some BJJ practitioners. Not only do the Sambists go for, horror of horrors, leg locks, they go for them hard. It's easy to see how this may have led to even further bad feelings from BJJ people towards Sambo and leg locks. Reputations are like rumors, or like playing the old party game, telephone. They often become distorted and expand when passed from person to person. But there is an equal distribution of good guys and of asshats and of people somewhere in between in every martial art. It's a foolish mistake to allow the rule set and culture of any given art or sport to prejudice you against the individuals who practice it. That's the Russian story. Next time, the modern story. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, and check out old episodes of the podcast at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.